So, Berto, did you know that recently, I think just this month, a bunch of therapists got together and decided to lie to the insurance company saying that, sessions were happening and they could get paid for doing nothing?
That's got to be a bluff.
It's a tough, but let's get into that after I introduce the podcast. This is the podcast called Psychology in Seattle. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Program at Antioch University, Seattle, and I'm also a licensed therapist.
My name is Humberto Castañeda. I'm an insurance adjuster, mostly specializing in psychology claims.
So I'll just quote from the article written by Al Hajjal. When patients arrived at New Century, a medical clinic in Flint, Michigan, so the agency is called New Century in Flint, Michigan. When patients arrived, they would hand over their Medicare information at the front desk, meet with a doctor, and receive prescription drugs including Vicodin, Xanax, and codeine. By the way, those are all abused drugs, so that's notable. We don't know if they were being abused, but, you know, a little suspicious there. Going on with the quote here. A local pharmacy would fill the prescriptions, and a courier would deliver the drugs to the clinic in bulk. While patients waited for their pills, they would hang out at the clinic watching television, doing arts and crafts, and playing pool. In exchange for the drugs, the patients would falsely state that they had received psychotherapy sessions at the clinic. To document what ostensibly happened during these fictional treatment sessions, the clinic's social workers would manufacture fake progress notes. As time went by, the clinic streamlined operations by allowing social workers to perform this work from home. A stack of blank progress notes would arrive at a social worker's house. The social worker would fill in the blanks, and other employees at the clinic would stamp the completed notes with the appropriate dates. What do you think, Berto?
That is both unbelievable, and at the same time, I'm like, oh my God, of course. How could this not be happening more often?
It does. And that's what I thought. And it has occurred to me before. I've never done it before, but it has totally occurred to me, because of how little oversight there is. Because
wow.
Because people will actually, I think one of my friends actually came to me, Nicole, actually said, you know what? Could we do this? Is this possible? just talking. And, you know, I'm so... honest. I was raised to be like, I don't even fake my taxes. Do you know what I mean? When everyone lies in their taxes,
right.
I don't even lie in my taxes. Like, even though the government will never audit me, it's just like, I never lie.
Right.
But anyway, it had occurred to me. I was like, so wait a second. I can send a bill to an insurance company and they'll pay for services and no one knows if those services actually took place. So
right.
I could get 20 of my friends, they could give me their insurance number, I could send claims in and I could split the money with everybody and we'd all be rich for doing nothing.
By the way, unrelated, but did you hear Nicole just bought a 150-foot yacht and a brand new mansion on the water?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Right. So these guys actually got caught. And
How did they get caught?
I think it was just starting to look really fishy. Oh, for instance, they had one patient having been in session for over 24 hours in one day. You know what I mean?
So they had one long session.
Yeah, they had billed for like 30 hours of psychotherapy for one patient in one day.
And who does the oversight? The insurance company or the?
Yeah, the insurance. Well, and Medicare is government, so government employees. And believe me, there are people who look into this sort of thing. But it's interesting that I don't hear more stories like this. Maybe they're happening all the time. But anyway, guess what? Some of the penalties were for these social workers and their bosses. So this involved the person who ran the clinic and the social workers and the clinical supervisors. It involved all levels of people at this agency.
Well, since people are in life in prison for pot possession in some cases, I'm imagining that they might even be on death row in some of these cases.
No, but seriously, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. They must have served some jail time, like 10 years.
Yeah, not bad. So one person, 2 years, and they had to pay about $400,000. Another person, 1 year, they paid $200,000. Another person, 8 years, they had to pay almost $1 million. Another person, 5 years, paid $1 million. Another person, 1 year, and they pay about $200,000.
Whoa, I wonder what, that's a big delta. One of them's 8 years. Is that just a lawyer differential?
Well, I think the 8 years was the CEO. Yeah.
Oh.
That was the CEO.
The head honcho.
And then the social workers, I think, were the least. Yeah.
So well, that should send a message, I guess.
Yeah. That makes sense if you're the ringleader and you're the boss.
So they must have been pulling in the bank.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. I'm not afraid to admit it had occurred to me before, and I thought, geez, you know, I wonder how easy this would be. But then my honesty, you know, quickly kicked in and said, it's not worth it. Plus,
after the first million, you were like, I shouldn't do this.
Yeah. Plus, it's not as if, you know, I don't have a job, you know.
Right.
If I was destitute and desperate, maybe I'd turn to such a thing, but I've never needed to, so.
Sounds like a Breaking Bad type of show.
It is kind of that way.
Or Weeds or something.
Yeah, yeah. All right, tougher bluff, Berto. What do you think? According to a recent study, having an advanced degree, so master's degree, doctorate degree, is not associated with greater mental well-being. Tougher bluff.
I would go bluff because that seems to contradict the research saying that like Alzheimer's is delayed by some number of years, other dementia is delayed by some number of years for the higher education that you have.
Well, it's tough. According to a recent study, just because you have an advanced degree, that does not mean that you have greater mental well-being. And I can absolutely attest to that. We have this stereotype. It's like, oh, you're rich and you have lots of degrees and your job is prestigious. You must be super happy. Believe me, as a therapist who not only works alongside highly privileged people, but also has highly privileged people coming into my office, I can tell you that highly privileged people are not necessarily any happier than people who are not privileged.
I guess I misunderstood in the sense that I thought it meant literally like brain chemical health, and I was referring to like people that have exercised their brain more throughout their adult life seems like they have later or no onset of dementia and stuff. But I could see how just because you have a higher degree would not necessarily make you any more, well-balanced or happy or any of these things.
Yeah, yeah. Tougher bluff. When prospective students emailed professors in doctoral business programs, women and minorities were ignored 2.2 times more often than white males. Tougher bluff. When prospective students emailed professors in doctoral business programs, so you have, you know, a doctorate in business and you have prospective students emailing the professors, women and minorities were ignored 2.2 times more often than emails from white males. Tougher bluff.
That is sad, but I bet you it's tough.
It is. It's tough.
Oh, brutal. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
All right. Along the same lines, when prospective students emailed professors in doctoral humanities programs, women and minorities were ignored just as often as white males. So, meaning that they didn't prefer white males in the doctoral humanities program. So again, you're a doctorate in literature, doctorate in history. So when prospective students emailed these professors, women and minorities were ignored just as often as white males. Tougher bluff.
I'm going to go bluff. I'm going to sadly say that they were still ignored more often.
Well, your belief in humans being terrible is upheld. It is bluff. They were ignored 1.4 times more often than white males. So that's 40% more often they were ignored in doctoral humanities programs,
oh my God,
which are supposed to be the liberal, you know, oasis. Doctoral humanities programs are the liberal oasis in you know, a vast sea of sexism, right?
I have two very ad hoc stories of me interacting with highly regarded professors in two different fields. One of them was a like an audio researcher, professor blah blah, and he was doing a lecture about this is for voice, like voice training and stuff, but using electrodes to detect how your vocal cords move and all these things. And I went up to talk to him, and I was explaining to him, you know, sometimes my throat gets sore because, and I don't know why, actually, it's a whole bunch of environmental factors. And I got the most dismissive, like almost disgust attitude from him. He's like, let me feel your neck. And like, he felt my neck. And he's like, yeah, I'm exaggerating only slightly. He's like, yeah, you have a displaced vertebra. And it was like, get out of my sight. I mean, like, again, it wasn't like he didn't literally say it, but his attitude and demeanor was like, ugh, of course, you're a mess, you know, like, get away. And then this other time I went, it was a totally different thing. It was at the Dartmouth College 50th anniversary of artificial intelligence. I went up to this professor after his lecture, highly regarded, you know, luminary in the field or whatever. But I just wanted to know how to get in contact with him, right? Because he must have an email address. So I'm like, oh, professor, loved the lecture. Could I write down your email address? And he's like, Google me. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I walked away. I'm like, I know I can, and he probably is Googleable, but it's such a like a snotty thing to say. And I couldn't help but notice that, like, in the first case, like, the professor, he was surrounded by young white females. In the second case, he was surrounded by, you know, white college guys. And I never thought about it at the time, but over the years, I kept thinking back, and I'm like, okay, maybe that's one of those times that you hear, like, oh, someone was discriminated. Because I never, like, know when it's happening, but then I'm always like, oh, that's kind of, that might be why he treated me so funny. Again, I don't know, but it was interesting. Like, and he wasn't treating other people this dismissively. So maybe it was just me. Maybe I just came up as like, yo, asshole, what's your email?
Right. And for those that have never seen you before, everyone should know that you're an albino.
a Hispanic albino.
And so that's why that, no, you're Hispanic and dark skin, dark hair.
And yeah, exactly. And I come off as non-standard, if you will.
Non-American
standard.
Yeah. Although the new standard is to be slightly brown in America.
That's true. So nowadays it might not be an issue. This is, after all, at least 8 or 9 years ago. So
yeah, right. That's what, you know, sexism and racism is like. You have an interaction. It seems like you're being treated unfairly. And you wonder, is this because I am female? Is this because I'm not white? And you look around and you think there's some evidence to point in that direction. And that's the thing about those interactions is you just never know. But in all likelihood, you've been treated differently according to your skin color or your gender. All right. There's an email here from listener Crimson Emo. This is a YouTube person.
By the way, both of those professors were Native American black women.
Yeah, right. Disabled. This is an email from the Crimson Emo. I really loved the point you brought up about how people nowadays are so set on working hard towards having extravagance in their life, and they don't even take the time to enjoy the life they have right in front of them or take the time to be with their family. I commend you, Crimson Emo, on your long sentence, but I totally agree with this, and I'm glad that you really loved the point, because I am very passionate about it. I think that our culture is totally backwards, and it's getting worse as time goes on, particularly in Seattle, since we're a tech city, and to get ahead, you got to work 70, 80 hours a week. I mean, you've worked at jobs before where it wasn't uncommon to sleep at the office.
That's right.
And that's just like ridiculous, you know. And, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s, you worked 9 to 5 and that was it. You didn't work. If you worked more than 40 hours a week, there was something really weird about your situation.
There was usually overtime involved, you know.
But a lot of jobs didn't have overtime.
Oh, okay.
Because it just was the situation where the expectation was like, I've got a family.
Yeah.
I've got a life.
Right.
I need to get home for dinner. You know, my family eats dinner at 5:30. I need to be home by then.
Right.
And whereas today, people don't eat dinner together anymore. And you work at home. You answer emails. The last thing before you go to bed at 12:30 is to answer emails from people at work. And if you don't answer these emails in a timely manner, not only will you get passed up for promotions, but you might actually even get fired. I mean, you know, I have clients. Yeah. I have clients who work for Microsoft and these other kinds of places, and they set it up so that it basically breeds this kind of workaholism by having different teams. And when a team is rated not as high as other teams, a team could get rated highly, but it's on a curve. So if you're one, you know, and you're being compared to the other 30 teams, and if your team gets rated, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, a 9.5, but everyone else is a 9.7, then you all get fired. And part of that has to do with how much hours you put in and how much, you know, productivity you have. And, you know, that's a function of how many hours you put into work. And I think it's a crime upon human beings, and it's anti-American to be pro-business in this way and anti-labor. We have moved away from unions and away from worker rights. And there's some movements I just read on the internet that Netflix is now giving unlimited maternity time for men and women. So there's definitely some movements and some progressive companies. But in general, I feel like things are just getting worse and worse and worse. And there's no pushback. I can't tell you how many times I've told clients that a major portion of their mental health and a major portion of the reason why they're in therapy has to do with the fact that they're working too much. Now, the working too much doesn't make them miserable, but the working too much means that they now can't work out, they can't eat healthy, they can't hang out with their family, they can't hang out with their children, they can't do their hobbies anymore. I can't tell you how many times I talk to clients and I say, well, what do you do to relax? What do you do for fun? They say, nothing. I say, well, did you ever do something? I say, yeah, when I was younger, I used to go fishing. Well, right. Why didn't you go fishing now? I don't have time to go fishing.
When would I go
fishing? And I'm like, what do you mean? You know, like, you don't have, like, this one client, he didn't even have kids, and he didn't have time to go fishing. And I'm thinking, you have presumably the entire weekend to go fishing. The other thing is because everyone's buying these really expensive homes and and they want their homes to be like super awesome, they're spending a lot of time making their house look expensive, making their house look rad, right? And so the little time they have,
remodel.
They're remodeling, keeping up with the Joneses. And when you are, you know, when you have a house that is a little big for your budget, you end up having to buy a house that is a fixer-upper. So that just furthers the problem, because now when you manage to get free time, you're spending it on remodeling your house. And that's all you're doing is working and remodeling and getting 4 hours of sleep, and you never work out, and everyone's getting fatter and more miserable and more anxious and more depressed and neglecting their children and neglecting themselves. And it's a freaking epidemic.
Gripes of wrath. I love it. No, I can't agree enough. I used to have a job that was like that, and it is never explicitly written. It's always just cultural. You know, like, you'll never find an employee manual that says, you pretty much got to put in 80 hours a week, you know? And oftentimes, it's not that you're literally at the office. Sometimes you're literally at the office 80 hours, right? Sometimes you're not. Like, you might be there only 50 hours. But what happens is, like what you were saying, it never stops. You leave the office and you're texting on the way home. Or not texting, but like answering emails on the way home. You get home and you're eating while you're answering emails.
Yeah.
And then you're answering emails while you're watching the one show you wanted to watch. Right. And then you're in the bed answering emails. Yeah. And then you wake up and you check your email.
Yeah.
And it's like that, because it feels that if you don't stay on top of everything, you're going to get swallowed up by the tide, man.
Right. And it's, yeah, it's cultural. And guess who wins?
Wall Street, I guess.
Yeah. And who is Wall Street?
Two people.
Well, who exactly wins by this cultural movement?
Well, not really anyone, though.
No, there are people who win.
But they have their own families that they're not paying attention
to. Who's winning? Who's losing the least, and who's losing more?
Certainly the people that are already independently wealthy are losing the least.
The super rich people who own all these these companies.
And countries.
Yeah. They have so much shares.
Yeah.
In these, I mean, why is the United States the most robust economy in the world? Well, it's partly because of this. We don't have that many people. We have a lot of people, but not as many people as other countries. So these super rich people are the ones that become even more super rich, because profits go up, because the workers are working themselves to the bone.
Yep.
The middle class person, you know, the average worker, suffers because they're working 80 hours a week and they don't earn any more money. Their salary is the same regardless. But if they don't do that for the super rich, then they will get fired.
But then when people say they want more, a higher minimum wage, people lose their shit. Okay, well, what? We can't do that. Everyone will go unemployed. I will go out of business.
I recently clicked on a Reddit or a news article or something that was claiming that the $15 Seattle downtown fast food minimum wage was ruining the economy or something. And I clicked on it. And I was like, oh, and because I always want to know, well, is there another argument? You know, I don't want to just live in a bubble.
Sure.
So I read the article, and it just had all these anecdotal accounts. No data.
I see.
No study. It was like, you know, the headline was, workers take time off now more because they don't, they because of their pay increase, they no longer qualify for welfare. So you know what I mean? So if you're earning $10 an hour as a downtown Seattle McDonald's employee, you only earn a certain amount per year, which means you actually get some government assistance for what, you know, to make up for the difference in terms of your income. So as your income goes up, the workers in Seattle, all of them, according to this article, are now cutting back their hours so that they can keep the same income level so that they can get all their welfare from the government.
Makes sense.
That's what they're saying. So,
but because, by the way, as you know, workers in those fields have a lot of control as to what hours they can and cannot work.
That's exactly what I thought. I was like, so let me get this straight. The workers of Seattle say, we're all going to work less, and none of them get fired. I mean, come on. You know what I mean? They had talked to one manager, unnamed or something, saying, oh, yeah, I have some employees who are trying to cut back on their hours. And then they draw a conclusion. It must be because they're trying to hold on to their welfare. And then I was like, oh, my God, this is ridiculous.
It's a hatchet job.
This is ridiculous. Now, maybe there is an argument against the $15 minimum wage. Maybe there is. But this was certainly not one of them in my book. So I go down to the comments and I'm like, well, surely there's going to be a lot of people making fun of this. Because I've been spoiled by Reddit, by the way. Because there's a lot of actually really smart, funny, rational, mature people on the Reddit pages I look at anyway. And so I was looking at the comments, and every comment was just a screed about how all of these welfare people are just sucking off the teat of America. And they're all just, you know, entitled, you know, assholes, just, you know, sucking us dry. And it just really made me think, like, okay, so let me get this straight. Someone gets an increase from $11 an hour to $15 an hour, which is an increase of about $23,000 a year to about $32,000 a year.
A year.
And a lot of these people are working parents.
Yeah.
$32,000 a year for being on your feet 8 hours a day and dealing with assholes like you. Okay.
Those greedy bastards.
You're going to rail against those people and not against the corporate rich. Yeah. I mean, who flagrantly in the wake of their own massive mistake that drained all of our bank accounts in 2000.
Trillions of dollars.
In 2008. Get bonuses given to them.
Millions.
And don't even apologize for it. So, you know, enough of my liberal bullshit. But anyway.
No, it's true, man. And you know, the other thing that comes to mind is this. Like, I worked at McDonald's. And I remember what it was like. It was not a fun time. Like, the best of the best is when I got to drive-thru. I got to work drive-thru. That was the high life because, like, I could be sitting there by the window and stuff like this. Still, though, this is a hard job, man.
Yeah, you said that. You were like, yeah, I got promoted to drive-thru. And when I heard that, I was like, how is drive-thru any... I mean, you're still working at McDonald's.
Nah, but you wear that cool little headset. But that's the point. Like,
Lobot.
This isn't some, like, luxurious. And I sure as hell didn't get to just dictate my hours.
Right.
It was a negotiation for sure. And, yeah. you know, they deal with a lot of teenagers. So you do, they know they have to be flexible for things like school and stuff. Yeah. But here's where they don't get to be flexible is when you're like, hey, man, I'm thinking of just cutting back. So I'm just getting, you know, like yeah. that doesn't work.
Yeah. If anything, those organizations are heavily weighted to management because they can always hire new people.
Absolutely.
Because they have a drawer full of resumes. And when you're pissing them off, they just stop scheduling you.
That's
right. They don't even have to fire you. All they have to do is just reduce your shifts. Yep. And then eventually you quit because you move on. And so there's all sorts of problems with that. And come on, people. Like, America has labor rights in our blood. We fought hard for it literally by our own lives in the early part of the 20th century. And I feel like we've completely lost sight of that identity. I feel like whenever unions are brought up or whenever labor movements are brought up or workers' rights, instantly you get labeled as a commie or some kind of liberal, progressive, anti-business person. No, it's not anti-business to be pro-worker. It's pro-American to be pro-worker. It's pro-human to be pro-worker. It is the capitalist job to squeeze every ounce out of the worker. And it's the worker's job to squeeze every ounce of money out of the corporation for the least amount of work. You work in against each other. That's how it works. And if things get out of balance and you privilege the capitalist, then the worker is going to suffer.
Welcome to CIS, Socialist Commies in Seattle.
It's funny. I had a client who is, you know, a finance guy. And, you know, he's one of those rich bankers that we talk about. And I can tell you that the rich bankers I'm talking about are not those guys. There's bankers, like just banker guys, you know, who worked at Goldman Sachs yeah. or, you know, investment guys. These guys did not, you know, they didn't get the bonuses. It's the CEOs of these companies. It's the super rich people that got the stuff. The general finance employees suffered along with us. Do you yeah, know what I mean?
Of course.
So I'm not targeting Goldman Sachs workers. I'm targeting the CEOs. I'm targeting I don't even blame the CEOs of these companies because, again, the capitalist job is to make money. The shareholders hold them to that requirement. The government is supposed to regulate that.
Yeah.
And make sure that this effort to make money does not ruin our country and our people.
Yeah.
And when you let them do whatever they want, because the thing is if you have two finance companies and one finance company is working a particular angle, but it's not good for the country, but it's legal, and the other company says, oh, that's wrong. You can't work that angle. That's wrong. Don't do that. Well, the company who doesn't work that angle will go out of business. So you got to work the angles. If another company's working an angle, you got to work the angle. But if the government makes that angle illegal, then neither company works that angle.
And they enforce it.
And they enforce it. Yeah. Then those companies don't work those angles and everyone wins, including yeah. the bankers.
Yeah, I think there's way too much regulation. We need to let them police themselves. That's clearly the solution.
No. We shouldn't. That's the whole thing. Like you know, it. The system is set up so that they shouldn't be policing themselves.
Of course.
When you give someone money and you say, "Make me money," I'm going to give you $10. Make me money. You don't necessarily care where that money is being made. You just want your interest to come back, and that's what these bankers get paid for.
And the higher, the better.
And the higher, the better. That's how everyone is. Now, some people are trying to make socially conscious investments, and that's, you know, a movement, but it's, you know, pretty minor, right?
I haven't even heard of it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Seriously. Like,
yeah, I give money to an organization that gives money to poor, actually a lot of women in third world countries as starter money for businesses.
That's awesome.
And I get updates on how much money they're making. And at any time, you can withdraw the money out, but you feel kind of shitty like taking money because they'll send you a picture. It's like, you know, some woman in Colombia is right. from your $100 has invested in a business walking water from the river to the village.
Right.
And she is now making a profit of $2 a day based on your $100 investment in her organization.
Right.
And it's like, give me that $2. Because you can do that. You can go, give me, you know, I own.
I want my profit.
Yeah. But it's like, oh, no, you can keep the $2. That was weird. Should I cut all that?
No, man. I think it's golden.
I don't think it's golden.
I think it's golden. It's not directly psychology, but it is affects all of us.
I think it's really.
I think it's bold.
It's too political.
But it's bold.
And it's too leftist.
What's leftist these days? Leftist these days is normal. Leftist these days is centrist.
It doesn't get any more communism than that.
It does. You're actually advocating for businesses with regulations. That's it. You're saying make your money. In fact, you went as far, which I wouldn't go, as saying, let the bankers go, man. But we just need laws that we regulate.
Yeah.
Like, that's way kinder than many of us would say.
No, that's reality. You want bankers to be greedy.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, you've seen the smartest guys in the room and stuff. There's people that are not just greedy. They're fundamentally a bit psychopathic.
You're going to get that.
And I'm just saying, like, what I'm trying to say is that you're far from being too hard on the left. You're just stating something that should be stated. It affects mental health directly of millions of Americans because they've lost jobs. They've had high stress. Remember how you started this in the first place? You were talking about the effect that the high stress that the jobs put on the workers has on them, on their families, on everything else. That's real.
Yeah.
If you don't talk about it, who's going to talk about it?
Having said all that, I will say that I come from a business education in which I believe in supply and demand and of competition and of letting the market be free. And that when you do that, you have innovation and you have people like Bill Gates and you have Steve Jobs. And if there's too many regulations, of which there are in other countries, and too many taxes, then it dissuades people from innovating and from creating jobs in the way that, you know, a good economic structure actually provides. So I'm not for creating a quote-unquote socialist nation like in other countries. I mean, look at Greece. They had big problems. And part of that is supposedly because of some of the ways in which their tax structure was structured. I don't know. But I definitely believe in the American way, but a little bit more regulation and a little bit more and a big amount of worker rights talk needs to be talked about.
But you have case studies like Iceland. Iceland did punish the bankers. They did punish. They sent people to jail, and then they instituted changes, and their economy is more than recovered. And it's, you know, you can go check out the research online and stuff like that. Like, they're a good case study for what happens when you don't just let things slide, when you don't call things too big to fail, when you bite the bullet and then make change, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's worthwhile talking about.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jesus, if you have anything to say, because I was basically talking out of my ass and you'd like to you would like to point that out, then feel free to email me at contact@psychologyinseattle.com or go to our website and fill out the contact us page. You can also donate, which is great. I'm trying to figure out a way that you can donate and win some swag or get some extra goodies for your donations. So watch out for that. You can take one of the continuing ed courses on the website. Just a reminder, these continuing ed courses are all you do is basically listen to the podcast and then take a super easy test after paying a very small fee, by the way. Because, you know, normally continuing ed is like, you know, a couple $100 for a 6-hour class.
Right.
And I've scaled that price per hour way down. And I think it's like $2 per hour. So, you know, if you can get like a 10-hour class for $25 or something. I can't remember the exact price. But anyway, you just take a super easy test that basically proves that you listen to it. But it's not a hard test. It's not like a test to stump you. It's a test, a very light test. You know what I mean? And when you take the test and you pay the fee, then you get continuing ed, which a lot of you therapists out there need for your licensure requirements. You can also like us on Facebook. And please participate in our weekly Tough or Bluffs. I have a Tuesday Tough or Bluff game that we play every week, and it always is fun to interact with the listeners in that way. All right, another email here from listener Florence. She says, great episode. Let's see, what episode was she talking about? Oh, the Inside Out episode.
Oh, nice.
She says, great episode. Totally thought about my own therapy while watching Inside Out, as my therapist is obsessed with emotions.
Oh.
What do you think about that?
Oh, I really enjoyed that one too. And I actually, we talked about it in the podcast, how it seems like those are types of models that people could use, especially with kids, but I think in general, like to discuss emotion, discuss feelings, discuss what's going through people's heads. They presented a simplistic but interesting way to think about how our personalities work and how our brain works. And I think it's useful for thinking that way when you're talking about your own emotions.
Yeah. All right, tougher bluff, Berto. Searching for information on the internet makes us feel dumber than we actually are. Tougher bluff. Searching for information on the internet makes us feel dumber than we actually are. Tougher bluff.
I feel like I need to look this up.
So you're Googling something, and then afterwards you take a little survey to rate how smart you feel you are. Does it go up, down, or stay the same?
Yeah, I guess you probably feel a little dumber, is my guess.
That's my intuition as well, but actually it's bluff. It makes us feel smarter than we actually are, which is another intuitive sense I have, because I think what it does, you know, so just, you know, if I said, Berto, rate your level of intelligence right now, and you're like, oh, I'm a 9.9 out of 100. and then I say, you know, Google some stuff. And you're like, you start Googling Wikipedia, blah, blah, blah. And then I say, rate your intelligence. You know, there's a chance, I'm guessing, that you would say, oh, I'm on 11 out of a scale from 1 to 100. Because
I've learned something.
You've learned something. And you feel like you have access to things or something.
That's actually, now that I think about it from that perspective, I can relate for sure. Because... guess what? I was just talking to someone about this the other day. I know what it was. I had this big, long debate about the Civil War and the Confederate flag on Facebook. And the thing is, I didn't grow up in this country. So I honestly never studied the Civil War. I think I took one history class in high school that briefly touched on the Civil War. And all I knew about the Confederate flag was that it was with the Dukes of Hazzard, which I loved, yeah, and the KKK, which I don't love anymore. and it was like, that's all I knew. And yet, I went online, I searched for documents that from the secession, and I did searches, and I read for a few hours, and all of a sudden, I felt like a freaking expert, man. It was great. And so I can relate to this idea that, like, if I look at the way I was thinking about it, was kind of that moment where you're like, oh, what's that guy's name? Oh, I can't, but I feel so dumb. I can't remember. Fine, I'll Google it. And that when you do that, it always feels like you've been defeated a bit. Mm. So I was thinking of it from that perspective.
Right. That we need the internet.
It's like, oh, I can't believe I can't remember. Oh, this is so stupid.
Yeah. I, you know, in my effort to learn about the other side of the aisle, whenever I, you know, am, you know, realizing a cultural phenomenon like the Confederate flag, I try to understand where these other people are coming from. Now, obviously, you have KKK people that are super into the Confederate flag. And these people are white supremacists. They presumably hate black people, or I think they also hated Catholics back in the day, and Jewish people, and, you know, whatever they considered was a different group than themselves, they hated. And the Confederate flag to them is holding on to those values. Okay. And then you have, is it the flag of South Carolina? It's like the state flag.
Which one? The Confederate flag?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, is the Confederate flag just, what is it? I thought it was South Carolina's state flag.
So the Confederate flag was the runner up of the seceding states union, or what they call it, the Confederacy. The,
yeah.
It was the runner-up flag,
uh-huh,
or at least a close variant of it was runner-up. And then in the 60s, it was adopted as, it was erected in the Capitol building as the flag, because they wanted to basically make a stand against integration and pro-segregation. So it became kind of like the rallying flag of that ideology.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought it was one of the state flags.
No.
So that flag has been flying in government buildings in South Carolina?
Yeah. and more than South Carolina. And the idea was...
I thought it was one of the state's flags.
But everyone's forgotten that, like... And I didn't know this either, right? But everyone's forgotten that, like, that's not even, like, exactly the Confederate flag. the Confederate flag was a circle of stars. Like, it looked different and stuff. But it was actually, that one was brought to the fore in the 60s, specifically when they were trying to do integration. And that was like a flying in the face of integration, like a big FU to integration.
To the Northerners who were trying to force integration on the Southerners.
It's when they were doing the military escorts of kids to schools and stuff. So, like, the claims are just sadly misinformed. You know, it's, no, this is our history, man. It's, I mean, it is history.
So this is what I wanted to get to, was that point, was that it's, to some people in the South, it symbolizes not necessarily white supremacy or anti-black people or something. I think to them, to some people, and I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt to some extent, it symbolizes to them their identity as a Southerner, you know, and probably some of that involves being white, right? But I think it also symbolizes to them, you know, not being a Northerner, right? Not being one of us on the progressive side, being conservative and, you know, rural and a hunter or a fisher or a, you know, a plumber.
A slave owner. You know, those kind of things. Yeah.
A hardworking American, you know, whatever their identity is. I think it also means something to some people along those lines. So I think when some people are wanting to hold on to that, I think, this is just my general hope in humanity, that they're not necessarily saying we're holding on to this because we believe white people are superior to black people. I would like to think that some of these people are holding on to it because they have pride in their cultural pocket. And really, the Southern white people are often, you know, there's a lot of working class, you know, dudes down there. And they are, to some extent, oppressed people economically.
That's right.
And so to them, it might feel like the big, rich Northerners are coming down and taking away their identity and telling them that they're not valid or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And white supremacy, you know, might be a part of that, but I have a hard time believing that there's a whole, you know, swath of Americans that want to hold on to a flag purely because they want to make black people feel like crap.
Right. Yeah, it's just like the extreme example would be that imagine if people wanted to defend, like, what's something really, really universally offensive? I don't even know.
Nazis.
I guess, but even that, like, I don't know. Anyways, I don't have a good example. I was going to say, like, you know, imagine that people liked, you know, dead, killed babies. And it's like, well, yeah, but this represents something to
me. Well,
it's
the anniversary of the Hiroshima bomb 70 years ago.
Oh, okay. So let's take that one, right? This is a very interesting...
Hiroshima is the way to pronounce it.
Hiroshima?
Hiroshima.
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 Hiroshima. So imagine that here in the United States, we generally... there was some pocket of us that flew a flag of, like, a mushroom cloud with the setting sun behind, or the rising sun behind it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and then people of Japan and here and there would be like, man, listen, I know that was a hard war and stuff, but come on, like, that's offensive. Like, I know we started, but you killed, like that's not a fun thing to celebrate, right?
Yeah.
And then we're like, what? Like, I know maybe at some point it meant that we've had this for 50 years, though.
Well, I'll give you another example. So I went to Issaquah High School, which is near Seattle. It's just like, I don't know, 20 miles east of Seattle. That's where I grew up, anyway, went to Issaquah High School. And back in the day, it was the Issaquah Indians.
Yeah. Okay?
And I just remember there was talk of changing the Indians to something else. And I remember a lot of people were not wanting to do that. This is our, you know, what do you mean change it? The Indians, you know, we're celebrating Native Americans. It's the same with the Redskins in Washington, D.C., right? Well, it was changed to the Eagles, which I'm really happy about. It was changed in the 90s, I think. So now it's the Issaquah Eagles, not the Issaquah Indians. And I am old enough, 44. I'm friends with a lot of alumni from this high school, both young and old. And it's pretty much split down the middle. You will talk to people like on the Facebook page for our high school. Right. They'll be like, and by the way, we're Issaquah Indians, not Issaquah Eagles. You know, there's a lot of people who talk like that.
Right.
And, you know, to them, they're not like, screw you, Native Americans. It has become something else because they were born into it. They, you know, it wasn't like they were born and they're like, okay, let's choose a mascot. We have Indians, we have Eagles, and then they heard the debate, and they're like, you know, there's going to be some people that are going to be upset with the Indians. And then they're like, I choose Indians. I'm going to choose it because it's going to upset Native Americans. No, they were given a label, and they celebrated that. It was on our T-shirts. It was on our football helmets. It was on our flags and our, you know, our pep rallies, and it was everywhere. And we had personal pride. And there was almost no opposition to this growing up. We heard about occasional people, maybe they were upset about it. But to us, we were the Issaquah Indians. It was a thing we were born into. And so I think it's the same with the Confederate flag. It's not like a kid born in the 60s or 70s in Alabama or South Carolina was like, ha-ha, I hate black people. I'm going to choose this flag. It was they hung out with their uncles and their grandpa and their grandma, and they saw this flag. And when people looked at the flag, they said, we love this flag because it symbolizes who we are in this community, us, these people that you love, that support you and love you. This is our flag. And then for, again, the Northerners to come down and say to that guy when he grows up to be 60, 70 years old and say, you know, you can't do that. This is not your flag. In fact, I'm going to make you take it down from your flagpole. You can imagine they're going to resist.
Right.
There's going to be some resistance.
That's right.
And I think that that's what's not being talked about. Now, I think the flag should absolutely be taken down. I mean, given its history, by all means, take it down and burn it. But
from the state capitol.
From public, everywhere.
No. Listen. From public places.
Yeah, from public places.
Because like...
Free speech. Right.
Because like, there's nothing wrong with things in museums, things in movies, things in shows that were already done.
Someone on their private property. If they want to have a Nazi flag...
But the Dukes of Hazzard, don't ban the Dukes of Hazzard. Like, it's been done.
Well, I don't think there's talks about banning
it. They were like iTunes removed Dukes of Hazzard.
But that's
like,
a private company.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, take it off the government official places. But yeah, you know, if someone wants to have it on their house, you know, it's free speech. You can do what you want. But the thing is
public property.
Yeah. But the thing is when the non-Southerners, you know, say, oh, you're a racist, you're terrible for holding on to that flag, I think they're missing that other element.
I used to fight, not publicly or anything, but I used to mentally be annoyed that I could no longer use fag in a derogatory manner. You know?
Like, right.
You fag, right? Yeah. But I grew up doing that, yeah. Right? So my argument, in fact, was, you know, well, but I mean, it doesn't mean that.
Yeah.
It's like, well, here's the catch. It did kind of mean that's how it started.
Yeah.
It's just that we started then using it more in general, right? But it did have that history. It meant you are a gay person and therefore you're being made fun of.
Right.
Even though we might know you're not or who knows, but even that's how it started.
Right.
And so I finally, and this took me years, I finally came to grips with the, oh, just because it's what I used to do doesn't mean it doesn't hurt people.
Right.
Right. And I think now to flip the coin around, I also find that like people shouldn't be so shocked that there has been so much resistance towards gay marriage, for example, because of the similar reasons. Because like, listen, it's totally like wrong that it wouldn't be allowed. Right. But at the same time, it's not surprising that people that grew up their whole life thinking it was not just wrong, but it was direly wrong based on their religion and things like that, that they would all of a sudden magically be like, oh, never mind. Everything's okay. Right.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not saying it's right, but it shouldn't be surprising. And we should be more empathetic towards like, well, why are they reacting like this? In fact, it isn't in many cases because they all hate gay people. It's in many cases because it threatens their beliefs and their religion and stuff like that.
Right.
And I think there's something, some corollary there.
Yeah. I think that this is the problem with the way these things are debated these days. It's the same with gun control. You know, I know people who have guns and who hunt. And these people are not the way that the left media will portray the gun, you know, crazies. What do they call them? Like gun
Confederate owners. Yeah. Confederate flag owners.
They call them like gun freaks or something.
Yeah,
right?
Gun nuts.
Gun nut. Anyway, the people that I know with guns are very into nature and they're not opposed to regulations, a lot of them. It's one thing when you have like the Westboro Church, right? This is basically a cult of, I don't know how many people, like 100 people or something. Like, I don't know how many people go to Westboro.
Yeah, it's probably about right.
Can't be that many. It's a small, tiny little, like, no, like a nothing little church in the middle of nowhere, but they're hugely famous because they have a mission to make themselves famous for, I don't even know why. And so, you know, we as a country can look at them and go like, something's wrong with you and ridicule them. In my mind, that's not that big of a deal.
But you still have to have empathy even then, because as you know, many of those members were indoctrinated from the time they were teeny.
Right. However, they're a cultural anomaly. Let's just put it that way. Now, but when you have half of the country believing in something, or half of a community, like half of the southern states or something, believing in something, then you have to wonder, there must be a reasonable side to the other side of the coin. There must be a reasonable argument for why people in the South are so upset when we tell them to get rid of their flag. There must be a reasonable reason why people get really upset when we say they can't have the Ten Commandments in the courthouse. When so many people get upset, there must be a reason. Now, it doesn't mean we have to agree with it. Doesn't mean it's a right thing, or it doesn't mean that we shouldn't debate the Constitution and the laws of this land, or change the laws of this land, or appeal to people's, you know, other thoughts or whatever. But what it does mean is you have to wonder, well, there must be something going on. Otherwise, so many people wouldn't believe that. You know what I mean?
I do. Now, I will say that in my attempts to have intelligent debate about it, sadly, I have found that facts don't matter as much. Like things like, you know, the blanket statement is like, first of all, the secession wasn't about slavery. You know, the Civil War wasn't about slavery. And that's the blanket statement. And I've heard very non-Southerner people stating that. And all the evidence, all the historical analysis, and I spent probably 16 hours of my life recently doing this, reading source documents where they literally state in their own words, this is about slavery and about the black man being inferior to the, but anyways, it doesn't matter.
Well, and just a side note, the reason why, as far as I can tell, that people who are looking for that answer, that it wasn't about slavery, the reason why they can find evidence of that is because the southern states would have never said that, because that would be abhorrent, right?
But they said it.
They did.
Oh yeah, it's all over their writing. Like it was clear as day. No. What happened?
But the top reason was because they didn't want the federal government to dictate their economic structure, to dictate how they did things, right? They just want the main tagline was we just want our freedom from the government. It wasn't like we want our slaves.
Well, the main tagline was along the lines of the root of our struggle and the root of our secession and the root of the conflict is about like the idea that we should abolish slavery when we have the right to have it. Because the thing is that that was their economic system. That was their lifestyle, right?
And their livelihood.
So, because
it basically destroyed their economy.
Yeah. Then it got sanitized throughout the years to be like, no, it was about states' rights and about taxation. Yes, it was about states' rights to have slaves.
Right.
And about the taxes about that slave labor.
Right.
So it's all semantics, right? But at the end of the day, it's not about, you know, hey, Abraham Lincoln was an angel. This guy's, it's not about that. Historically speaking, you're only going to be by, like, look, I didn't grow up in this country. I have no stake in the North or the South. I'm just like, I don't like segregation. I don't like oppression and stuff like that, right? And I've overcome in my life my biases, right? Or at least many of them.
Side note, I did grow up in this country, and I don't have a stake in it either, because the West Coast was pretty much excluded from that fight. You know what
Certainly
I mean?
Certainly when you were by the time the West Coast started happening, it was many years later. That's for sure.
Like, there's all sorts of racist issues that just never touched me in my community growing up, like anti-Semitism. Like, whenever I bump up against anti-Semitism or people who are worried about anti-Semitism, I'm always like, oh yeah, that's a thing. Because growing up, no one cared. There were Jewish people and there were Catholics and there were Christians and there were Mormons and there were, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses and, you know, there were, I'm guessing there must have been some Hindus in there. And no one cared. There were atheists. Just no one. I just remember hearing hints of it some places.
You lived in a local bubble, basically.
Yeah. And you know, there was talk, you know, about like, oh, the Mormons are a cult, or, you know, the Catholics are, you know, they just have too many children or something. But it was really minor, you know, because everyone, there wasn't a history the way that you have in the East Coast and in the South of, you know, literal wars over this sort of thing.
And I grew up in my own bubble because in Bogota, like if you had asked me at the time when I was like 12, hey, are people racist here? Are you racist? Are people racist? I would have said, no, what do you mean? That's no, of course not. And then you drive around and you're like, hey, quick question. Why are all the street urchins, all the street kids, like really native looking? And why are all the servants in the houses all very native looking? And why are the richer people all very more European, white, Spanish looking? And why are there almost no blacks in the center of the country? And the ones that are there, like, are very poor. And, you know, like, all these questions, you just never think of them. Yeah. And why was there only one Asian in my school that got teased mercilessly? You know, like, we were very racist.
But
like,
he was really good at math.
He was very good at math. Like, very racist, very insular. But that's true of every pocket culture, right? Yeah. And it was really horrible moment years later when I was in Florida with some friends of mine and they started saying some extremely racist things about black people because one of them worked in Florida and he managed a fast food place and he worked with, he managed black people and he was definitely calling them the N-word and like being extremely racist. And I was sitting there and I was like, guys, like, do you not understand that we're still treated poorly in this country as a minority? I mean, like, it was weird. Mm-hmm. And then that was kind of an eye-opening moment. I never realized that was true. And I left when I was 15, so I think I might have never seen, because, you know, when you get older in high school, a lot of weird kind of dark sides start coming out of your culture around you. Mm-hmm. And it caught me off guard. Mm-hmm. So I say this as someone who comes from a racist culture. Mm-hmm. And who doesn't have a lot of pride one way or another on this or that about American history. It's just as an outside observer in that sense, yeah, it was messed up and people's feelings hurt when you see that flag. So yeah, but at the same time, you're right. Not everyone is out to like be necessarily a racist or something. It's just to them, they grew up with it. That's the only, that's a symbol that makes some meaning for them. And
right. Yeah. Having said that, my culture that I grew up in was absolutely racist and absolutely sexist and absolutely, you know, elitist and all, you know, whatever you want to say. Classist is the word I'm looking for. And I absorbed all of those, you know, preferences and attitudes and internalized lots of things. So
which is good.
Yeah. But not the things that other communities suffer from. Like the anti-Semitism, for whatever reason, and maybe I'd have to ask my Jewish friends growing up if they experienced it, but I certainly didn't sense it, you know? No one talked bad about Jewish people when I was growing up.
My dad talked very bad about Jewish people.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he's got Jewish friends.
Yeah. And I certainly didn't feel the North versus South thing, you know?
Right.
In fact, I remember when I learned about it, you know, when I was an adult or something, I just thought, what? And I remember hearing that there were people still in the South that would, you know, refuse to accept that they were part of the, you know, they called it the War of Northern Aggression.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
And I just thought, really? Like 150 years later, there are still people holding out on that? I just thought.
And I had a very romantic notion about it because I thought of movies like
Firefly.
What?
Firefly.
Yeah.
The brown coats.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
They're the Confederate.
Right, yeah. But I'm thinking, like, way younger, like Disney stuff. In my mind, I was thinking, what's the Uncle Tom's Cabin? But what's the Disney movie that had the... see, this just shows my ignorance. But there was a movie with the one with Br'er Rabbit. What's that one? Br'er Rabbit and he ends up in the Briar Patch and... Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, man. They have a ride. The ride at Disneyland, that's the Splash Mountain.
Uh-huh.
That one's themed after that.
Huh. It's not a Jungle Book.
No, it's something Critters or something. Anyways, here's my point. From as a kid, I always had this very romantic notion of the South of the United States. In fact, you know, because I read Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer and all these things. And I had this, like, romantic notion of, like, oh, these nice plantations. And people are all so friendly and the food's really nice. And the black people are all very kind because they're the servants. And, you know, like, that's how I thought of it, you know.
Isn't in Huckleberry Finn, isn't...
He's a slave. He's an ex-slave, right?
What's his name?
Huck Finn and my friend... what's his name?
I want to say Friday, but that's Moby Dick, right? But anyway, but I thought, like, in that book, it's pretty clear that he's running from slavery, right?
Yeah, and it still sounded romantic. They go down the river in the little boat, and there's the little ferry, and
yeah.
It's just like, and the thing about Tom Sawyer with Injun Joe,
yeah.
Remember this?
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty racist, right?
No, it's terrible. Yeah.
But I, in my mind, it was very romantic. Like, yeah. It's just funny. Like, as a kid, this is how indoctrination happens, even when you're growing up in Colombia.
Yeah.
So I actually never thought of it like the North and the South. I always thought, oh, that's so wonderful. They have this southern part of the country that's so nice and peaceful. And yeah.
I remember when I was in Memphis and I was talking with a black woman who lives down there. She was actually a worker at a museum that was dedicated to the Underground Railroad.
Where
they would smuggle black slaves to the North to be free. And we were just talking. We were the only ones at the museum, by the way. There was literally no one else there. And so I had the owner all to myself, and we were just chatting. And she said, I said, well, you know, it's all different now, right? And she's like, are you kidding me? I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, you know, we're still living in a super racist culture. And I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense to me because you're Memphis, which is like half black. Everywhere I look, there's black people. How is it still a problem? And she said, well, you're just hanging out in the black neighborhoods, one. Two, see that building over there, that high school? That's named after a slave owner. Like a world-renowned slave owner.
In your face.
Oh, no, a slave trader. A slave trader. Gosh. Someone who made all of his money off of slaves. And he said, see that high school? That's named after that guy. And there's a statue of him in the front, you know, of the building. And it's 99% black people who go there. And the entire community has tried to get him to change the name to anything else. Just name it the Eagles.
Yeah.
You know? And... they won't do it.
It's our story. It's our history.
They won't do it because the white administration refuses. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Right.
I mean, imagine that in Seattle.
Right.
Imagine you had a high school named after a slave trader.
Right.
Not just a plantation dude, yeah. But someone who made tons of dough trading Africans, you know, capturing Africans, bringing them to the United States, selling them into slavery. And how many people died in the transportation and da 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 da. You name a high school after this guy. And obviously people step forward and say, could we please change it? And then the community's like, no, we're not going to change it. Again, part of that Eagles Indians thing, Missisquoi High School. But the name of the dude, I mean.
Now, that said, we do name a lot of high schools after founding fathers of the country who were also plantation owners and slave owners.
True.
But in general, that's part of the... In fact, by the way, that was in my debate, that was part of the argument that was, well, you know, no one's complaining about the American flag, and it stands for a lot of oppression and things like that. And I was like, that's a fair point.
Yeah.
One of the things that we have to deal
with...
Yeah,
it's a fair... Jefferson.
Jefferson. Jefferson High.
Not only owned tons of slaves, but also, you know, had sex with... a lot of the women slaves. And, you know, that's not a power differential at all, right?
And I guess that's one of the things to remember is that it's in our culture for both good and bad. It's all over the place, right? So like, if you want to say it's all gone, it's impossible because it's everywhere, right? Yeah. And by the way, it's Jim. Jim, Big Jim.
Oh, that's his name, Jim.
And I feel dumber now that I had to look it up in Google.
Well, I feel dumb because that doesn't even ring a bell. I've read the book. I saw a play of it recently at Book It Theater at Seattle Center, which I highly recommend to anyone in Seattle. Book It Theater.
I love Book It.
Yeah, they take books, classics, and convert them into plays, and they'll usually have a local playwright do it, which means that they take all the entertaining bits from a book and depict it. And so they'll summarize an entire book very quickly in a couple hours. And I was recently a technical advisor for Slaughterhouse-Five.
Oh, wow.
Which is really fun because it's about World War II and PTSD.
I wanted to go to that. I heard all sorts of great things.
It was amazing. And little side note, tons of full frontal nudity.
I know. That's why I wanted to go.
Did you hear that?
Yeah. When I heard about it, I tried to buy tickets online and they had just finished playing.
What do you mean? You heard about the full frontal nudity?
Yes.
Did I tell you about it?
No.
Oh.
A friend of mine told me.
Yeah. It was shocking. I had no idea it was going to happen. Okay, there's full frontal nudity, like in the court, like when you see in a movie where, it's just a flash, you see a ball or a dong or a dark triangle or a boob or something. This was actors, women and men, standing, and Book It Theater's small. It's probably, I don't know, probably like 30, 40 seats. I mean, there's only like five rows of seats, And I think I'm in the second row. And so these people are just a few feet away from me. And they did entire scenes, full frontal, just standing there, completely naked. And there was this one scene where they were military guys lined up naked, like at attention or something. Like they were, I think they were prisoners or something.
At full attention?
Yeah. The thing is we as Americans anyway, and I'm guessing a lot of cultures, we never see real naked people. We rarely see naked people.
No, we don't.
We rarely see naked people. And when we do, 99.9999% of the time, it is someone who's been photoshopped or heavily, done up or shot in a particular light or something. I mean, I would venture to say most Americans have rarely even seen their spouses
fully naked.
Naked in this fashion where you're just staring at their bodies.
That's right.
Under the lights while everyone else is in the dark, and all you can do is just stare at four 35-year-old dudes just standing there with their dongs.
I gotta say, I'm personally fascinated by nudity in theater because it poses this like incredible paradox, or paradox is not the word, like hypocrisy. Like we're sitting there in like all educated form watching theater and there's nude people like right in front of you and it's perfectly acceptable, my dear. But if that happens in any other context, it's like, oh my gosh, that's too much information, or put that away, or you scared the children, or you've abused me. It's like, why? It's similar to the whole underwear bikini thing. Like, oh, I saw you in your underwear, as opposed to like, oh, you're wearing a bikini.
Yeah.
Right? But this one's like to the 10th power. I saw a play. It was called something cowgirl. Oh, what was it? Something about a cowgirl or something. And they had full frontal as well. And later we had a little cocktail party with the cast, meaning I was invited to a cocktail. And I'm shaking their hands. And I'm just sitting there like, this is so bizarre. Like, I just saw you naked, like, just an hour ago. Like, and I was sitting front row too. So, like, we're, like, basically in the same vicinity of, like, body, right? And now we're just here casually talking and we're both clothed. And if I was like, hey, can I see you naked again? It'd be like, oh my God, this guy's an asshole. Get him out of my sight. Right. But, and that I just find these things very funny because
you should have walked in naked.
I should have. Oh, what? What? You guys can be naked, but I can't?
Yeah.
Psychologically, I find it fascinating.
Yeah, it is totally culturally bizarre. Culturally bizarre. Yeah. Did you hear about Lenny Kravitz having his?
Oh, did I ever?
Did you see the picture?
I did.
I didn't. What did it look like?
Oh, he's got a piercing.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. It looks, I don't understand piercings on your penis, meaning like that just seems so painful and disruptive to your flow. Ow. But yeah. Anyways, people do it. So.
Yeah. Do you believe that it was an actual malfunction?
I don't think a guy wants his pants to rip like that. I've had leather.
Why didn't he have underwear on?
That's probably his style, you know? Like, he seems like the kind of guy who just kind of doesn't wear underwear. Definitely don't believe that was, like, his plan. Because, like, again, it's just not, especially the way it would happen. He's in the middle of a solo. It'd be, like, very exhibitionist of him to be like, I'm going to crouch down and I know these pants are going to rip.
He crouched down?
He crouched down, and as he
like
crouched
he did,
down.
He did squats.
Yeah, the pants literally tore at the seam. And so, whoop-a-ho in your face.
I heard he covered it up with his guitar.
Yeah, it's probably right. He was very well groomed.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, there wasn't much hair to speak of.
Oh. So
but, you know, it's also, I mean,
there were no, he had hardwood floors.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's a little grainy, but you can kind of not see any hair there. So.
And apparently not grainy enough to not see his piercing. Where's the piercing?
At the top, at the base of the shaft, so that it can hit the clit. To each his own.
All right, well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. My God, was that a rando episode?
Whoa!
I mean, I please, people, understand that I was just talking randomly, and I don't normally do that, so...
This is going to be one of the higher-rated ones.
I don't know, man.
Not by professionals, but...
I don't know.
I mean, think about what you stood for. You stood for... better working conditions, better family life, more tolerance and understanding. I mean, those are good things to stand by.
All right. Well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. And if you want to contact us, you can email us at contact@psychologyinseattle.com or go to the website at psychologyinseattle.com and click on the Contact Us tab and fill out the form and email us. We always love hearing from our listeners. You can also donate by clicking on the donate button on our website. You can also like us on Facebook and participate in the weekly Tough or Bluff games. I just want to say that if you get Tough or Bluffs wrong, that is totally fine. I usually design the Tough or Bluffs to be a little tricky, so it's not like if you get Tough or Bluffs wrong, then you're stupid. That is not the point. Paulette once told me that she felt dumb because she was getting Tough or Bluffs wrong. That's not the point. The point of Tough or Bluffs is to get a conversation going and to impart, you know, some research knowledge. It's not to be smart or dumb. When I've played Tough or Bluffs, I almost always get them wrong. Even of the things I really should get right, you know.
Especially when the difference for Berto Tough or Bluffs is between 1.1 and 1.2.
Yeah, when Berto pulls a Berto, it's kind of hard to get him right in the first place. So don't worry when you get him wrong. I've been there before. Like when I get a trivia, I was playing trivia at a trivia night someplace, and I can't remember what the question was, but they were like, you know, I know a lot about astronomy and that kind of stuff. And I remember I was like, oh, great, it's an astronomy question. And I announced to my team that I was like, oh, I've got this. This is so easy. It's obviously the Saturn V rocket. I mean, come on. You know, and everyone's like, oh, Kirk, you know so much about this. And then I totally got it wrong. I mean, it's one thing to just be wrong. You know, it's like no big deal. It's another thing to be an arrogant ass and just be like, oh my God, this is so simple. And then, so I totally understand how you can feel humiliated when you get something wrong, but know that you need to have self-confidence or evaluative processes about your self-worth that are way beyond the Tough or Bluff right or wrong scorecard. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Amen, brother.
For you, you have a lot of confidence in your intelligence that when you're wrong on Tough or Bluff, I feel like it doesn't faze you.
Oh, it doesn't? Oh, maybe I should.
I feel like a lot of things don't really faze you.
That's probably true. Yeah.
I feel like you have a pretty impervious self-esteem.
Well, what is that supposed to mean?
I feel like for the most part, you just don't really care that much, or you have confidence or you trust people, or I don't know. What is it?
It's that scene in that movie you probably haven't seen where Princess Leia says, I don't think your friend cares about anything or anyone. And then Luke goes, I care.
Right. Anyway, goodbye, y'all.